Cheers.
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up? This is a
big
party, man.
Brother,
dig it.
Stop right on.
Hey, man.
Normally, this is Earl Ingram's voice. You'll be hearing this is Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram. Actually, I'm sitting in for Earl Ingram and Gilbert Brown. Now, that's filling some really big chairs, in fact. I'll be here this morning, the Juneteenth day. Earl has a much earned day off, and Juneteenth day is an important day to celebrate. Calvin, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Looking forward to a good week. How are you, Sandy?
Well, I'm pretty good. You're very quiet.
Let's see what I can do about that.
There you go. Juneteenth Day. You know, it's a pretty important day. You know, the sin of slavery that America had was not a sin only shared by Americans. Slavery has been something that's kind of plagued mankind for a long time. Back 2,000 years ago, at the time of Christ, there were plenty of people enslaved and people at risk of being enslaved by the Roman Empire. And just about every empire in the past has enslaved people. The people enslaved weren't just Africans. The Jews were enslaved to build, in fact, some of the Colosseum in Rome was built by Jewish slaves. The Egyptians enslaved Jews. And in fact, Russia, interestingly, the Emancipation Proclamation in the United States in 1861, in that very same year in Russia, which had the feudal system that operated for a very long time, they had serfs. And the serfs in Russia were, in fact, enslaved, and they were released from slavery in 1861 at the very same time. So in the mid-19th century, the world seemed to wake up and realize that slavery was not a tenable thing, something that shouldn't continue to exist. And happily here in America, we rid ourselves of it. And we celebrate it today, a federal holiday, Juneteenth. It'll be interesting. I'd be interested in CJ and others who call in, because we worry about the things we teach in our curriculum in school and whether we have critical race theory. But Juneteenth is actually a federal holiday designed to remind us all, much like Germans need to be reminded of the horrors that occurred during World War II. It seems to me that we in America do need to be reminded of the horror of slavery and the glory that was the release of the slaves. So I think we celebrate Juneteenth Day appropriately, and it is now a federal holiday, which is what it ought to be. Calvin, this is a call-in show. How do people call into this show?
You call in at 844-967-2789.
And, you know, normally when Earl's here, we have some levity in the beginning. We talk about, well, sports. Well, baseball. I was listening to the news there about the Pittsburgh game, and it struck me that they spent more words talking about what could happen in an inning and what could happen in a baseball game than I can possibly waste here today on baseball. We have Bradley Beal being traded. That is big news. And I think last week Earl was expressing hope that Beal might come to the Bucks. It looks like he's not. He's going to the Suns. And then after we talk about sports or something light, we have a whole litany of topics that pop up in the news in the current events. Today we have China. China's in the news because we have Secretary of State Blinken making a visit to China that's getting a lot of attention. He had a meeting with Xi just today or in the last hours, and apparently that meeting lasted 35 minutes. But the ballyhoo about the meeting is important because obviously tensions with China have risen to a near crescendo. And while we would point at the Chinese and say that tensions have heightened because of their conduct, most of this crescendo is coming from the United States. It's coming from the conduct of Nancy Pelosi going to Taiwan, followed by Kevin McCarthy greeting the president of Taiwan here in the United States, followed by just a great deal of discussion about China and the possibility that we needed to arm ourselves for the possibility of a war with China. All of this without, as far as I can tell, very much in the way of bellicose language coming from China. We have China, however, which it has the temerity right now of becoming a very successful economy. And according to the conservative theories that became prevalent in the United States in the 1990s, the so-called neoconservatives, who were sort of in charge of the foreign affairs under Clinton and after the fall of Russia, the neocons' view was that the United States was to be the dominant country in the world perpetually and for as long as possible, and that we would do all that we could to make sure that that would continue to be the case, not just militarily, but also economically. And I fear that our problem with China right now is more premised on the fact that China is becoming going quickly in the direction of becoming our economic equal. And for instance, today, Xi is there visiting Germany. And the reason is that China is Germany's biggest trading partner. China is very important to Germany. And so, you know, we should recognize, and we do recognize, the importance of China in the world. And I fear that it's that importance itself which is creating our hostilities, and which are the hostilities which we know we need to tamp down, because we cannot afford, and the world cannot afford, for China and the United States to be at loggerheads. And then we have, of course, Donald Trump. We always talk about Donald Trump. And I fear everything that could be said about Donald Trump has been, but I also fear that we're just at the very beginning of a whole nother time period in which Donald Trump will be seizing all of our interest for a long time. We've got the campaign. We have debates that are coming up in just months. And so there'll be enough said about Donald Trump. We don't need to spend much time on him today. And then, of course, there's weather disasters. They happen every day. And right now we've got weather disasters sweeping the southern United States. And, you know, is there a climate change? Do we have to worry about the climate? Well, regardless of the cause of the climate change, there clearly is a climate change. And every day you can read about it in the headlines in the newspaper. You can also, if you try to read scientific journals, find out that our scientists are finding out more and more about the climate. I mentioned last week about the newly discovered changes in what will be the current, the changes that will occur and are occurring in the very important currents in the oceans that are essentially the heat exchangers for the Earth that moderate temperatures in the tropics and moderate temperatures in Northern Europe. And across the world. And those things are likely to change and likely to change during our lifetime. So, weather. You know, all these things are kind of potential doomsdays, I suppose. We also have the Ukraine war. And the Ukraine war consumes our news daily. It gets to the back pages because there's not much new to report other than the fact that it continues. And there's also not much accurate to report because, lacking war correspondents like we've had in prior circumstances, we're left with the propaganda that is issued by the combatants, the Ukrainian news, in quotes, and the Russian news, in quotes, neither of which are to be trusted. And I think everyone knowledgeable about news will tell you that the news coming from either side is not to be trusted. So then the question is, what is actually happening in Ukraine? And that becomes a bit more of a mystery. Sports, we talked about Beal. We also have the golf. And golf is one of the few sports where someone named Wyndham Clark would win a championship. I mean, only in golf would we find, and I'm surprised his name isn't Wyndham Clark III, because that would have been so much more appropriate, but no. So, you know, we can go through all that litany, but today I thought, having this show to myself to deal with and to fill the shoes of Earl, I thought we could maybe talk about some themes. And today, the theme I'd like to talk about is the healthcare in this country, the status of healthcare, the status of health in this country, and the problem that healthcare poses, not just to Tom, Dick, and Mary, but to our country, the burden that it places on our economy, the huge expenditures we have. So we'll be going to a break. When we come back, I expect to talk more about healthcare. I've got some guests today to talk about it, from various vantage points. So we'll be with you after the break. It's Healthcare Day. Right on.
Just simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Pick it flat and pick it sound. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. Can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh.
Right on. Right on.
Very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Bright sunshine today with a high of 82. Winds out of the east, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows dip down to about 57 tonight. Clear skies. Clear skies and quiet again tomorrow. Daytime highs approaching 82. Dry with temperatures near average Wednesday and Thursday, and highs in the low 80s. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 63.
Good morning, Sandy Williams, sitting in for not only Earl Ingram, but Gilbert Brown. I mean, talk about two big guys to sit in for. And today we're, as I said before the break, I think we're going to spend some time talking about healthcare. You know, we spend so much time, radio talk shows and radio and news generally, talking about the brush fires each day. And, you know, the brush fires are so predictable. I went through the litany before the break, you know, we've got China, dealings with China, something that sort of a problem we create, and now we're trying to stifle it. We've got Donald Trump. My God, that's something we can talk about any day, every day. Weather disasters, Ukrainian war. It's the same list. And one of the things that we don't do is talk about issues that hang over our heads every day, problems that we don't solve. And one of the biggest problems, I think, one of the ones that affects Tom, Dick, and Mary every day is health care, the cost of health care, the cost of health care insurance, the number of people uninsured. And if you just look at the data, you can see that the data tells us that health care is a serious problem in the United States. We spend in various years ranging from 17.8 to almost 20% of our GDP is spent on health care. That's an enormous number. It's an enormous number not only because it's enormous for our country, but it's enormous as compared to any other country. I think Germany's the next highest, and in the year measured, it was under 13% that they spent on health care of their GDP. And if you look at the per capita expenditure, you can say, okay, well, we've got a lot of people. We spend more money. No, not actually. We spend 40, 50, 60% more per capita than any other country and double almost any other country. So, you know, by any measure, we spend an enormous amount on health care, and that health care is a burden to us. So I asked a good friend, you know, there's an ad on TV that's about the most interesting man in the world, and that man is bearded, and actually the most interesting man in the world is John Hopkins, who's on the line, who's here with me. And John isn't bearded, but John knows a great deal about health care. John's a computer scientist, but he's applied his career in computer science to the healthcare. John, how are you this morning?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Sandy.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talked to you, I think, maybe a month ago, and I thought you had some interesting vantage points to talk about some of this stuff about. But let's first try to qualify for people the extent to which healthcare is a problem for the American economy. I was giving some data there, but it's a burden that rests over the economy, rests over the people, and rests over the government, right?
It is. It's you started out with a couple of interesting statistics, but if we look at the numbers, we spend this 2022 is the last year we have numbers for, is about $4.3 trillion on healthcare, and that includes pharmaceuticals, going to the hospital, going to the doctor, buying a walker. Whereas the military, we spend about $877 billion,
I think that 877 is about 4% of our GDP.
Correct.
And incidentally, both of these numbers are not magnified as they could be by the extent to which all that money, when it goes into the hands of the goes into the pockets of the people who receive it in those industries, gets spent at restaurants, gets spent at drugstores, gets spent at grocery stores, mm-hmm. and it gets magnified so that the percentage of our total GDP that's dependent on these things is larger than if you add those two together and get 24%. It's got to be a number up in the 35% range of our GDP that is dependent on these two industries.
Right. And I'm not sure what the exact number is there, but it could be easily 35, maybe even 40%. It's a very wide reaching number. Just like when people talk about the military complex, and the extent that it affects things, the healthcare complex is even more far reaching.
I mean, much, much, much bigger, right? I mean, the healthcare industry is by far our biggest industry. So, you know, people who want to beat their breasts about the American economy should recognize that our economy is in so many ways dependent on two industries, healthcare and defense, both of which have sort of a parasitic effect on the economy. I mean, they certainly draw from the economy money that could otherwise be spent on other things. I mean, how does it compare to education, for instance?
Well, education is around, federal government discretionary spending is about $78 billion in 2022. So one-tenth of the military and, just a tiny little fraction of healthcare. And yet you could have a tremendous amount of leverage if you spent more in education that might help you alleviate some of the healthcare issues that we have.
So, I mean, you know, the dollars are finite and we spend this enormous amount of money on healthcare. And we spend, a second level enormous amount of money on defense, all of which is money that could be expended on daycare for children, on education, educating our populace, could be spent on infrastructure improvements, high speed rail, a variety of other things which it's not spent on. And so, you know, I think And how are the outcomes from our healthcare system? I mean, are we doing well? We spend so much more than everyone else. We must have much better outcomes for our population.
Well, we come in sort of in the top half, but only around the halfway mark. We don't do better.
Good morning. This is Wake Up Music. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram and Gilbert Brown.
Wow.
And this morning I'm talking to John Hopkins. John is, we're talking about healthcare, issues associated with healthcare. Before the break, we introduced the subject by talking about how very, very much the United States spends on healthcare. And we didn't get very far in comparing it to how much is spent by other countries. We spend how much per capita, John, you were saying off the air?
Well, 2022, about $12,500 per person.
That's the amount that is expended either by the government or in private ways on healthcare per individual. That number is materially higher than any of the other developed countries by a factor of what? Is it 50%
really?
Higher?
At least 50%. In many cases, it's 3 times to 4 times higher.
And so we've got more spent, considerably more spent per capita. We also have an immensely larger amount as a percentage of our GDP, approaching 20%. The rest of the developed countries approach 12%. So that's a huge dollar difference. And how much money does the federal government expend on healthcare, John, if you look at like Medicare and Medicaid?
Yeah, so Medicare, which is the system for people over 65, is about $750 billion a year. And Medicaid for disadvantaged is about $730 billion a year. So roughly equal. And that comes to about a third of the total spend in the United States.
So that's a third of the total healthcare spend.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that number is immense, and it's immense. It's immense even compared to our defense budget. For the two of them together are materially larger than our defense budget. Each one of them standing alone approaches our defense budget, but not equal
correct.
To it. But the point is, if we expended the same amount per capita in the United States as other developed countries, those numbers would be much, much lower. So if we're 50% higher, you can take a third of those numbers off, right? I mean, if we were going to try to equal a country that was spending 50% per capita that we spend, how much would those numbers go down?
Well, you'd take well, it depends on the nature of them, but if you took that down to say $300 billion a year each, and you have two components to it. You have the demand. In other words, why are people demanding the healthcare? Do they need it because of chronic illness or acute illness? And then the actual cost. Once I've decided, oh yeah, I have this chronic disease that needs to be treated, what's the overall
cost?
Sure.
But we're talking now about the spend. So we're talking about what they spend, which is related to costs. So if we reduced so we got down to a country that had a spend that was 50% less than ours, we'd end up with, let's say, Let's take conservative numbers, $500 billion. We could save $250 billion a year off of each one of those expenditures. That's $500 billion a year. That's far more money saved than what Congress ever talks about chiseling off of the benefits side to try and save money in our federal budget. So if we, as a country, began to attack our per capita medical costs to get it in line with what other countries spend, you know, we could save an enormous amount of money that could be devoted then to health care, child daycare, and other things. Now, if we did that, do these other countries have worse medical outcomes than the United States? Or it's my understanding, John, they have better outcomes than we do, don't they?
In many cases, they have better outcomes. And the outcome is defined as the quality of life following the procedure or the treatment.
Well, but there's there's some outcomes we can measure. We've got life expectancy. Mm-hmm. Life expectancy in the United States has declined more than the life expectancy in any of these other countries, I believe. We've got infant mortality. Infant mortality levels in the United States are the worst of, I think, any of the developed countries. We've got maternal mortality, you know, during birth, the death of mothers. That's also a number in the United States, which is materially worse than almost every other developed country. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think you can pick apart outcomes in the United States and find out that our outcomes for almost any kind of process are not better than other countries. The other number that astounded me was, okay, we spend so much money on medical care, and we have so much in the way of developed and sophisticated medical care available. We must visit doctors more often than other countries. But the fact is that the per capita visitation of physicians by Americans is lower than almost any of the other developed countries. We don't go to doctors. Why don't we go to doctors? We can't afford to go to doctors. We're afraid to bear the expense of going to doctors because the kind of healthcare insurance we have causes us to spend out of pocket money that we're fearful about spending if we go to doctors. Mm-hmm. So,
and you know. We're also steered towards very expensive specialization very soon in the process. Whereas a lot of other countries, you visit primary care physicians more often, and they work with you at a earlier point in your healthcare journey, and they see you more frequently.
Of course, one of the reasons we get steered towards specialists so quickly is we're a relatively sick population. We aren't well compared to the rest of the world, are we? I mean, my understanding is that not only are we getting older, but we're getting heavier and we're having chronic diseases at a greater rate.
That is very true. And the United States is the global leader in having multiple chronic conditions. And that chronic conditions such as chronic heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, diseases that are long-term and don't necessarily kill you right away, but lead to a long-term period of treatment that is expensive, either through medication or through medical procedures.
So
having multiple of those even multiplies the effect.
So we've got, I mean, if you look at outcomes, medical outcomes, one of the medical outcomes in the United States is that wellness has not progressed very well in the United States. We, whatever our medical system is, whatever our cultural system is, we as a culture have not been achieving wellness at the same degree that the rest of the world does. And these chronic conditions that you've talked about are basically environmentally induced, aren't they? They basically are induced through what we eat and what we do.
They're all lifestyle and dietary changes. If you look at, and if you combine obesity and smoking, you have a particularly noxious combination of factors. If you look at pre-World War I incidence of lung cancer in the United States, it was very, very low, tiny percentage. As the soldiers returned from World War I and took up smoking and started to encourage their girlfriends to smoke, the rate of lung cancer skyrocketed in the United States between 1920 and 1950s, and then started to level out as we understood the dangers of it. So there are environmental factors like that that are purely lifestyle induced, and yet we are not motivated, we are not incented to take care of ourselves. We know that we should, like taking your vitamins, but monetarily we have very few incentives, and most people are motivated by their pocketbook. We know that for all sorts of things, not just their healthcare. And so the focus on wellness has to go back to monetary incentives. And that is because people need to say, wow, if I don't take care of myself, it's going to get really expensive.
And in the United States, I take it, if you are in a third-party payor system like we are, the government is your payor, an insurance company is your payor, your pocketbook might feel the expense of minor illness, but major illness, which falls above the deductible level of all this stuff, is not something that is born out of your pocketbook.
Right. So if you wind up having a stent put in that costs, say, $85,000, you might see $2,000 or $3,000 of it, or $1,500 of it, or maybe nothing, depending on your coverage. And so you are not terribly worried about it.
By a stent, you're talking about the things that they put in coronary arteries to keep them open, so that one's blood flows to the heart, which is someplace where you want your blood to flow to.
Yes. And it's become such a common procedure these days that people just talk about it as if they're having a filling put in. And yet the number that we do every year, it's about 2 million a year. So a population of 340 million, that's still a high percentage of people who have a $90,000 procedure.
And one of the other things to point out about that is that whether that procedure costs $70,000 or $80,000 or $90,000 or $120,000, the patient doesn't bear a different cost once they reach that whatever deductible level that they have for their insurance. Mm-hmm. They don't see the rest of that cost. So from a medical system standpoint, there's no incentive to control costs, apparently. In fact, maybe when we get back from the break, I suspect, but we can talk about it. But are there incentives to actually inflate the costs and not to reduce the cost? Because there must be something wrong with the American healthcare system that causes our healthcare to cost so much more than the healthcare in other countries.
Yes, and I think that is something we want to definitely address, which is the feedback loop actually promotes an increase in the costs. And if you think about the two layers of indirection between a patient whose employer, for example, pays the premium, which pays the insurance company, which eventually pays the hospital system, they are so far removed from that financial decision as to be completely insulated from it.
You're talking about the patient. The patient is like, yeah, they can't even sense it. There's no sensory organ that can tell them that it's expensive, because in the circumstance of an employer carrying the cost of their benefits, they don't even know how much the benefits cost.
No. So you'll go out and buy a $120 sump pump to make sure your basement doesn't flood, because that would be catastrophic. Because you know that if it does, you're on the hook to pay for that. Your house, you know, people are very careful about their material possessions because that has a direct financial impact on them. And yet we're so insulated from this that the insurance has really become a completely opaque wall that very few people, despite their best efforts, can penetrate.
Now, these other countries that we're talking about, Germany and others, all have government-sponsored healthcare, so that there is a government that's bearing the cost. But those governments must be more proactive about controlling the healthcare costs per se in their country than we are. And so I think that's another thing for us to reflect on. I think in the United States, we have K Street, this lobby, this place where lobbying occurs, and lobbying occurs on behalf of the big pharma. lobbying occurs mm-hmm. on behalf of the healthcare institutions that provide the actual healthcare. It occurs on behalf of the insurance industries that are so all of these elements of our expenses seem to be well represented in government in a way that seems to insulate them from cost controls that even the government might employ. So I think when we talk about costs, we need to and cost incentives, we need to focus on patients, but also on the government, which ends up being under any system, even today's system where we don't have health care for all, a source of expenditure for, as you described it, well over a third of the health spend. We'll be back after the break to talk more with John Hopkins and more about healthcare. Sitting in for Earl Ingram and Gilbert Brown. Instead of Gilbert Brown, I've got John Hopkins here. There's some difference, probably 190 pounds of difference at least. And we're talking about healthcare. And before the break, we were talking about the amount we spend on healthcare, and we were talking about outcomes. So, you know, as we return here, it seems to me that there's money, so much money to be saved in the United States on healthcare. Were we to be able to deliver healthcare at the same level of efficiency as it is delivered in other countries, why can't we, John? What's the deal?
I think there's a number of factors. One, we have we deliver healthcare actually pretty efficiently in terms of the actual process. We have some really wonderful hospital systems. We have technology that's the envy of the world. We have a high financial burden in the bureaucracy of these systems, in the management structures, and in the insurance processing system. Depending on how you measure it, and this is always a number of dispute, but the overhead that you incur due to the insurance system itself is anywhere between 15% and 20%. So automatically you've got that tax on top. That's just the processing and the management of that whole industry. That does not account for whatever profit that happens on top of that. Now
there would have to be, I mean, if it was government delivered, there would have to be a government cost associated with administering it. So, but there is definitely money to be saved through a more efficient administration process, is what you're saying.
There is. And people often talk about single payer systems, and I think that's something we need to address for just a moment. You have the Canadian system, for example, which is a pure single payer system. You just go to the hospital. And
incidentally, I looked at that, and Canada's per capita GDP percent of GDP expenditure is 11.7%, and their per capita expense, this neighbor to the north of us that has a profile that in almost every way looks like our profile, and their per capita expense is a fraction of ours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now they have a system that people often do complain about because there's very few ways to buy additional private insurance that speeds things up there. In France, you have, for example, a healthcare system that is largely single payer from a variety of funds, but nonetheless, it looks like single payer. But you have to pay for your healthcare up front, and then you are reimbursed later on. So you are very much aware of what your healthcare is costing. Now, in Singapore, for example, they have a system where they only supply catastrophic insurance, and the person has to pay for their health care underneath that.
Although that's going, Singapore's program has government subsidies for, they have health savings accounts as one of the tranches, and those health savings accounts can be funded for the needy by the government. So they right. have ways of delivering government support, but it keeps the patient directly in tune with the costs, right? Because it depletes.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're being forced to think about how they're spending their money. And this is where, you know, we really need to get to a point where we're starting to think about how we actually are reversing this trend, which is, can we become a country where we're really innovating in terms of how you dramatically lower the cost of delivering the healthcare, not by 10%, nobody cares about 10%, by a factor of 10, so that something that was 5,000 is now 500. People call that poppycock, but we've seen this, as we've talked about before, with the SpaceX mission. What NASA cost them, you know, $100 billion, SpaceX is able to do for $10 billion. So we know that when we put our minds to it, we can dramatically change the delivery mechanism for a system if there is a financial incentive to do so.
Well, I think you have an example about that, John. I think MRIs, as delivered 10 years ago by hospitals when MRIs were part of an integrated system of diagnostics, the cost of an MRI was very expensive. Today, you can have an MRI done at a specialty shop, right, where all they do is MRIs, and the cost differential is substantial, isn't it?
That's correct. You can go to a dedicated imaging clinic and you can get an MRI or CT for several hundred dollars versus a couple of thousand dollars in a hospital system. And for people who are self-funded, meaning they or their company pay directly out of their pocket, this is a consideration, and they can be rewarded for saying, I'm going to choose the $500 MRI instead of the $2,200 MRI at my hospital system. And the employer builds in an incentive that says, if you choose that, I'm going to give you $50 or $75 or $100 even, straight back to you. It's the same imaging equipment, it's the same outcome, it's the same, often the same radiologist reading the image, and yet you have in this case, it's less than 20% of what the hospital system cost is.
So that's the result of market, right? That's the action of a competitive marketplace. And what clearly
Correct.
Is lacking in our healthcare system is an effective marketplace where you have disciplined buyers, people who are interested in finding less costly but equally efficacious kinds of equally effective kinds of treatment. And that's what we don't have in our system. And before the break, I was talking about all the lobbying organizations that exist to lobby our federal government, and much of what those lobbying organizations do on behalf of hospitals and on behalf of insurance companies and on behalf of a variety of these entities is to make sure that the government doesn't negotiate hard on prices, but rather pays them generously. And the same is true with Big Pharma. I think, John, it's true, isn't it, that you can go to a foreign country and get drugs far cheaper than you can buy those drugs in the United States?
For literally 1/100th of the cost.
Yeah. Well, okay, we're coming up on a break now. We've got David from Mequon and John from Boaz. And so when we come back, I think we'll take some calls to talk more about healthcare in the United States and some of the issues we've got and how do we fix them.